He walked out from behind his desk and stuck out a huge hand.
"Good morning, Piquet."
He was even bigger than Lieutenant Smith, and his tummy stuck out in front of him even more than Harry Crown's. Like the lieutenant and clip cop, he wore the grey military-style uniform of a prison warder. The only differences were 4 stars and a crown on his shoulder tabs, and a small tab of blue velvet inserted into the top of his lapels. I shook his hand shyly, not quite knowing what to say.
"Sit, son."
He pointed to the remaining leather chair. I pushed myself up into the large chair. By sitting on the edge, I could make my feet almost reach the ground. Commandant Van Zyl sat down heavily on the sofa.
"So, you want to see a professor?"
I nodded my head.
"Yes, please, sir."
The commandant adjusted himself on the sofa, his body soaking up most of it.
"The law says he must be detained, and I must follow the law. But inside this place, I am the law. And here he can come and go as he pleases, provided he stays within the gates. Also, he can have visitors in official visiting hours."
He looked at me and smiled.
"I have decided to make an exception in your case. You can come any time you want, only not Sundays."
He paused and looked at me again.
"How do you like that, eh? Two old marts together again."
"Thank you, Meneer Van Zyl," I said.
"Ach, man, it's nothing."
He looked at Lieutenant Smith as though he felt the need to explain his decision.
"A friendship between a man and a boy is not a thing to be broken. This boy has no father. I know what that is like, man. My father died with the Carolina Burgers at Spion Kop when I was the same age."
"Yes, sir," Lieutenant Smith said, looking down at his hands, which were crossed on his lap.
"Make out a permanent pass for the boy, so he can come any time except Sunday, you hear?"
"Ja, Commandant." Smith looked at the larger man. "What about the professor's piano?" Commandant Van Zyl slapped his hand on his thigh.
"I clean forgot. Thank you, Smith."
He turned to me.
"We are going to let the professor have his piano here. There are already many musicians amongst us. Everybody thinks Boer are not cultured, but I'm telling you, man, when it comes to music, we leave everyone for dead. For us, it is an honor to have a man such as him in our prison community. Machtig, a real professor of music here in Barberton Prison. Wunderlich."
"Thank you for letting me come to see him, meneer."
"The boy has nice manners. I like that,"
he said to Lieutenant Smith.
"It's nothing. You can come any time, you hear?"
He hesitated for a moment.
"Piquet, we need just a small favor. On Monday, about 1 o'clock, we will be having a nice little surprise for the townfolk in the market square. Already telephoned the mayor, but I can't trust him to tell people. Will you inform Mrs. Boxall, who telephoned about you, and who I understand is also a friend of the professor? Ask her to tell everyone, you hear?"
I nodded and he seemed pleased.
"Danke, Piquet. I think we will like each other a lot. Now, Lieutenant Smith is going to take you to see the professor. I see you have some books for him."
He stretched his hand out.
"Show me."
I jumped down from the big chair and handed the books to him. He opened the top one and leafed through it for a few moments.
"Plants. I don't know much about plants. Animals, that's my speciality. You can ask me anything about animals, you name it."
He brought his hands up as though he was squinting down the barrel of a rifle, pulled an imaginary trigger and made a small explosive sound.
"I've shot it."
He lowered the imaginary rifle and grinned at me. He had 2 gold teeth.
"I love wild animals," he said.
His hands returned to the books, which he handed back to me, and his face wore a look of benign satisfaction as he scanned the trophies around the walls. Lieutenant Smith cleared his throat loudly, and the commandant turned back to us.
"Well, it's been nice to meet you, Piquet."
He patted me briefly on the shoulder.
"If you want anything, you just come and see me, you hear?"
It was like the time I had to decide whether to offer to do the judge's arithmetic. Like then, I was doing pretty well. Why risk it? If I got on the wrong side of the lieutenant, I stood to lose everything, even the chance of becoming a boxer once I turned 10.
Please, Meneer Van Zyl, could I learn to box here?
The commandant had already risen from the sofa, preparing to dismiss us.
You want to box?
He looked at me.
That's the lieutenant's department. I already told the boy he must wait until he is 10. Then maybe,
Smith said, trying not to sound terse.
When you're 7, it's a long time to wait until you're 10. It's nearly half your life,
the commandant said.
We train at 5:30 in the morning. Unless he lived here, how could he get here?
I will get here, I promise. I will never miss, not even once. Please, Meneer Smith.
Lieutenant Smith looked down at his boots for a long time.
We can try when your jaw is fixed, but I must have a note from your mother to say it's okay to teach you.
He looked up, appealing directly to the commandant.
He is too small, commandant. He will grow, Smith. As I recall, you and your younger brother started very young. Is he still fighting?
Yes, sir. His next fight is against Odendal.
That's right. A low-felt heavyweight title next Saturday. You must get me tickets, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir. Your secretary has them, sir.
Commandant Van Zyl ushered us to the door.
All the best, PK.
When we reached the bottom of the stairs, Smith stopped, and getting down on his haunches, he grabbed me by the front of the shirt. He had said nothing when we left the commandant's office, but I was too good at listening to silence not to know I was in real trouble. I closed my eyes, waiting for the clout across the head that must inevitably come. I hadn't been hit for a year, except for a few hidings from my mother, which you couldn't really call hidings after what I'd been through. But the memory of a skull-stunning blow across the head was still very much a part of my experience. To my surprise, the blow didn't come, and I opened my eyes again to look straight into Lieutenant Smith's angry face.
I'm telling you flat. Don't do that to me again, you hear? When I tell you something, I mean it, man.
He shook me hard, expecting me to cry. Instead, I held his gaze.
Who you looking at? You trying to be cheeky?
Please, Meneer, I saw your brother fight in Havelot last year. That's when I decided.
A look of amazement crossed Smith's face.
You were there? Vrachtig, you saw that fight?
I nodded.
He fought Hoppy Grunewald. Kid Lewis, I corrected.
Lieutenant Smith released his grip on the front of my shirt.
I was there also. Machtig, that was a fight and a half. You saw it, honest.
He rose from his haunches and suddenly his eyes grew wide.
The kid with Hoppy Grunewald. I remember now, we thought you was his kid.
We had reached the office again. Klipkop was on the floor doing push-ups and broke his sequence and stood up rather foolishly as we entered.
You know the fight in Havelot my brother had against Grunewald the welterweight last year?
Klipkop nodded.
PK saw that fight. He's a personal friend of Grunewald.
The warder laughed.
I lost a fiver on that fight. Who would have expected a welter to beat the light heavy? I'm telling you, Grunewald isn't just an ordinary welter. You mark my words, if he comes out of this war, he's going to be South African champ. You can put money on it, Smith said. He'd take you with one arm behind his back, man.
Klipkop grinned.
That'll be the Frosty Friday, no way, man. I'm going to do the same to your brother on Saturday as he did. Don't be so bloody sure of yourself, Odendal. Jackhammer Smith is no pushover. This time he'll be fit. Don't count your bloody chickens before they hatch.
Smith turned to me suddenly.
Okay, I changed my mind. You're on the squad, but no fighting for 2 years, you hear? Just training and learning your punches and technique, you understand me?
I nodded, overjoyed. My eyes brimmed with tears. I had taken the first step to becoming the welterweight champion of the world.
Klipkop, take PK to see the professor. I'll make a phone call and you can meet him in the warder's mess.
He turned to me.
Come back when you're finished and I'll have your permanent pass ready for you.
We left the administration block and passed through another building. This is the gymnasium for the prison officers, Klipkop said. We walked over to the punching bag and the boxing ring set up at one end of the large room. Large leather balls lay on the floor, and Klipkop bent down and scooped one up in his hand. Here, PK, hold on to this. I put both my hands out, and he flipped the ball lightly into them, and suddenly I was sitting on the floor with Klipkop laughing over me. It's a medicine ball, and it weighs 15 pounds. When you can throw one of these over my head, you'll be strong enough to begin to box. I got up feeling very foolish. Then I bent down and tried to pick the large brown leather ball up. Using all my strength, I managed to lift it, but was happy to let it drop again. Not bad, PK, Klipkop said with a grin. We were standing next to the ring, and I liked the smell of the canvas and the sweat. I wondered how I could possibly wait 2 years before I climbed into the ring to face a real opponent. We left the gymnasium and crossed the huge indoor courtyard, an area half the size of a football field, which I had seen from the top of the hill on my first morning in Barberton. The prison blocks rose up on every side of the square, where 2 old lags were raking its neat gravel surface, so all the tiny rake lines ran diagonally across the quad. It's Friday, diagonal lines. I like Monday best when they make a big star in the middle, Klipkop said. I wasn't sure what he meant, but I was soon to learn that each day had a different rake pattern. It was how the prisoners knew what day of the week it was.
Well, the prisoners, Klipkop? I asked.
The 2 old lags doing the raking were the only humans I had seen since leaving the administration building.
Ach, man, they're all out in work gangs. Most work on farms, some at the quarries and some at the sawmills at Ferencina's Rust. The people who hire them must call for their gangs at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they got to be back here by 6 o'clock at night. What you see around here in the daytime is just old lags, too old to work hard, like that black bastard who makes our tea. Also the murderers, they're not allowed to come out of their cells, even to eat. But we don't keep them long, man. It's not good to have murderers around, the other kaffir prisoners get very restless. He grinned. The warders don't like them around also, so we hang them jolly quick smart, I'm telling you.
What about the white prisoners? Do they also work in the gangs?
Klipkop looked surprised.
No bloody fear. Gangs is not the white man's work. Mostly white men are only here in transit to Pretoria. They don't have to work so hard because they're not here for long. If they're real hard cases, like that guy who murdered his wife and 3 children in Noordkaap, we just locked him up till the district judge sentenced him. Then we put him on the train to Pretoria. If you're lucky, you get sent along as a guard. You get a day off in Pretoria and 10 and 6 pence expenses.
We had crossed the gravel quad and passed through a narrow archway which led to the back of the prison. A long corrugated iron shed stretched from the main building, and smoke rose from 3 chimneys along its length. Kitchens. The warder's mess is on the other side, Klipkop said. Doc was overjoyed to see me, and he hugged me and patted me on the head, and his sharp blue eyes went watery.
Now I see I can sleep again. Let me see your jaw. Oh, I only wish I could have taken the kick, then you would be okay. Yes, I think so. PK, why are the peace lovers always the first to suffer in the war? Can you talk?
I'd never seen him so worked up, and his words tumbled out so that I had no chance of getting a word in.
My jaw is not so bad. They are going to take the wire out in 6 weeks, maybe even 4. But I have learned to talk with my mouth shut.
Doc laughed.
You and I, PK. Even when they cement our mouths, we find a way to talk.
He was still patting me on the head, as though to reassure himself that it was really me. I handed him the books from Mrs. Boxall, and he held them briefly before putting them on the table beside him.
She's a good woman, not so stupid either. You and she, PK, 11 out of 10 for brains. Absolute. Also, Mr. Andrews, I do not think they would listen to a poor old German professor of music on his own. German measles was in the air, and only you and Mrs. Boxall don't catch a big dose, yeah?
He chuckled at his sad little joke.
I can come and visit you as much as I like, I said happily.
Doc looked bemused.
Without the hills, it will not be the same. What can I teach you here, my friend?
Lots of things, like out of books and things. And I could go into the mountains and find things and bring them here, and then we could talk about them.
Doc gave me one of his proper grins.
You're right, Piqué. A man is only free when he is free in his heart. We will be friends like always. Absolute. But also, one more thing. They are going to let me have the Steinway here. You can continue your lessons. You must tell your mother this. I think she will be happy. On Monday, they are letting me come with them to get it. If they move it wrong, it can be damaged. I will see my cactus garden one last time. Maybe also you can be there, Piqué?
Dr. Simpson had said that another week's recuperation was in order. My grandpa had given me a big wink and said,
Who are we to argue?
I'll be waiting for you. I've already planted the Senecio serpents, just like you said, facing east.
Doc looked pleased, but then a worried expression crossed his face.
Piqué, on Monday is happening a stupid thing. It is not my decision, but please, you must trust me. That is why I want you to be there. I think Commandant Van Zyl wants to be a schmartypants with some people in this town. I am too old for such silly games. You will help me, please?
Commandant Van Zyl said I was to tell Mrs. Boxall everyone has to be in the market square at 1 o'clock. But he didn't say what it was all about.
Just then, Clip-Cop emerged from the door leading to the kitchen, carrying a small plate of roast potatoes. Here, have some, he said, offering me the plate. I pointed to my wired mouth, and he laughed.
Sorry, man, I clean forgot.
He offered the plate to Doc, who shook his head.
Monday, Piqué. Be so kind as to be at the cactus garden at 12 o'clock. Then I will explain. Also, tomorrow maybe find for me Beethoven's Symphony No. 5. You will see on the cover is printed my name and Berlin, 1925. Inside I have marked the score. That is the one I want.
I knew where to look, for the music Doc played, only to himself, was kept under the seat of his own piano stool. I found it strange that he would ask me to find it. After all, he knew perfectly well where it was.
Piqué, put what's above the score in my water flask. The key for the piano stool lid you will find under the pot on the stoop, where grows the aloe saponaria.
He said all this in a perfectly straight voice, in English. Clip-Cop appeared either not to understand or to be disinterested. I looked quizzically at Doc, but he put his forefinger to his lips and indicated the warder with his eyes. A hooter sounded somewhere in the prison.
Lunchtime, Piqué. We must get back to the lieutenant and the professor must go to lunch.
Clip-Cop pushed the last potato into his mouth. You can stay if you want and have lunch with the prison warders.
I have to get home for lunch. Thank you, Mr. Odendahl. What is the time, please?
That was the 12 o'clock hooter. Just call me Clip-Cop, okay?
I nodded. I was becoming accustomed to calling adults by their Christian names. I would have to run all the way home, as my mother would expect me back from the library by now. I wasn't at all sure how she would take the news of my potential comings and goings to the Barberton prison, nor how I would break the news to her. This more immediate preoccupation made me forget Doc's curious instructions. After Sunday school the next day, I went to the cactus garden. Dum and Dee had the afternoon off on Sundays, and had excitedly agreed to come with me to clean things up a bit for Doc's return the following day. They took brooms and feather dusters and other cleaning things in 2 galvanized iron buckets, which they carried on their heads, chatting away happily about how they would clean my friend's house like it had never been cleaned before. There wasn't much they could do on their half-day off, as they hadn't yet learned to speak Swazi. While I didn't think of it at the time, they must have felt isolated from their own kind. On the farm, they had been at the center of things. Quite important, really, by comparison with the farm workers, certainly a notch up the social ladder. Here they were 2 lonely little girls, who outside our home could make no contact, and who knew no other people. We were their family, and they were as cloistered as nuns in a convent. When we arrived at the cactus garden, they set to, delighted that they owned every inch of the task without supervision from anyone. I went straight to the large terracotta pot on the stoop of Doc's cottage, where aloe saponaria, also known as soap aloe, was growing. It has spots of lighter green and rust on its thick leaves. It was with some difficulty that I pushed the large terracotta pot aside, to reveal the key to Doc's piano stool. I hurried to the stool and opened it. The recess was almost a foot deep, and it was packed with sheets of music and handwritten music manuscript. There was also a bunch of programs tied with tape, though at the time I didn't know what they were. The top one had Doc's name on it, and the rest was written in German. I dug down quite deeply into the manuscripts and sheet music without finding Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Then lifting another batch of paper, I revealed a bottle of Johnny Walker Scotch. I lifted the bottle, and directly under it was the piece of music for which Doc had asked. On Friday afternoon after lunch, I had gone to see Mrs. Boxall in the library to give her the Commandant's message.
"Whatever do you think they're up to, P.K.?"
she had said, a worried look on her face.
"Do you think it has anything to do with the Professor?" "I don't think so. At 12 o'clock they're going to fetch the Steinway and take it to the prison. Doc asked me to be there to help him." "My God, he's going to give a concert. The Professor is going to give a concert in the Market Square. How thrilling, how perfectly thrilling."
I had never seen her so excited. It was suddenly also clear to me.
"I don't think he's very happy about it. He said Mr. Van Zyl was trying to be a smarty-pants with the people of the town, that he would need my help."
Mrs. Boxall, in her excitement, appeared not to have heard me.
"I once checked up on our professor. He turned out to be terribly famous."
Her eyes shone.
"There's something dark and very mysterious about it all, if you ask me. Why would a famous European pianist give it all up and bury himself in a tiny dorp in Africa, where he lives on the smell of an oily rag, giving lessons to little girls? I think he just likes collecting things like cactus and aloes and climbing in the mountains," I said,
though she didn't appear to be listening. She had her elbow on the desk, chin cupped in her hand, and was obviously deep in thought.
"P.K., did he ask you to do anything? I mean, when he said he needed your help?" "He asked me to get out Beethoven's Fifth Symphony with his name on it and Berlin on the cover."
"Hip, hip, hooray! Jolly good show! Beethoven, eh? What a treat we're in for. I heard the Fifth for the first time when I was a gal, and we travelled up to London to hear the brilliant young Arthur Rubinstein play at the Albert Hall." Mrs. Boxall clasped her hands and looked up at the ceiling fan turning fitfully above her head.
"Oh, bliss! Oh, blissful bliss! He also said I must put what is above the sheet music into his water flask."
"Whatever can he mean?" she said absently. It was obvious her mind was on Doc's concert in the Market Square, and her duty as the town's cultural representative was clear. This was no time to attempt to solve one of Doc's conundrums.
"P.K., you'll have to excuse me, my dear. I think we're going to have to close early today. I have such a lot of phoning to do. 1 o'clock. Are you sure that's the time, Mr. Van Zyl said?"
I nodded and prepared to leave.
"You will thank your dear mother for my lovely roses. I shall write her a nice note next week."
She had already started her telephoning, and as I went out of the door of the library, I heard her say,
"Barbara, you'll never guess."
Now I stood holding Doc's music, staring down at the bottle of Johnny Walker. Doc only ever drank in his room. Why would he keep a bottle in his piano stool? If Klipkop hadn't walked in at the moment he was about to tell me, everything would have been clear. I reached into my pocket for Doc's note and read it again. Maybe there was a clue I'd missed. I kept coming back to the last words.
"And whiskey is getting easier not to have."
Had I been older, it wouldn't have been a puzzle at all. But 7-year-olds are not very good at puzzles and usually know nothing about the drinking habits of grown-ups. I wasn't at all sure I was doing the right thing, but the bottle was directly above the musical score Doc wanted, and it was the only item in the piano stool which you could pour into a water flask. I was more than a little conscious that when I had last interfered with Doc's whiskey, the repercussions had been enormous. I took the water flask and the bottle of Johnny Walker into the cactus garden, where I dug a hole in the ground and planted the flask with its neck protruding. I must say it was a good plan, and I spilled hardly any. After that, I planted the bottle upside down. It was to be the last Johnny Walker bottle to be planted in Doc's cactus garden. I returned the flask to the piano stool, placing Doc's musical score over it. Then I locked the seat and put the key in my pocket. I was waiting at Doc's cottage by 9 a.m. on Monday morning. Dee and Dum had cleaned everything, and the place was spotless. The Steinway shone like a mirror from a fresh coat of beeswax. The girls had spent an hour cleaning the whiskey from the keys. Seated on the two piano stools, they had giggled fit to burst at the cacophony they made. I didn't believe they ever had a more enjoyable afternoon. They continued to clean Doc's cottage every Sunday afternoon for the next 4 years, until I'm sure they believed it was their sabbatical home. I passed the time waiting for Doc, separating succulents and generally clearing weeds from a small part of the garden. After a couple of hours, I heard the low whine of a truck, and the less agonized sound of a light van as they made their way up the steep road to the cottage. The black prison flat top was a diamond T. The van, coming along behind it, waited a little way down the road while the truck turned to face downhill again. On the back were 6 black prisoners and 2 warders carrying rifles. The driver and 3rd warder sat in front. I recognized one of the warders as the young one who had let me into the prison on the previous Friday, and I said hello. He jumped down from the back of the truck and stuck his hand out. Gert Maria, hoe gaat het? I shook his hand and replied that I was well, and in the Afrikaans manner inquired formally about his health. Just then the van drew up, and I could see that Klipkop was driving, and Lieutenant Smit was beside him. They stopped in front of the lorry, and Klipkop jumped out. Walking to the rear of the van, he unlocked it. To my surprise, Doc stepped out. He was dressed in a clean white shirt, blue tie, and his white linen suit. The place where his knee had torn through the trouser leg when the sergeant's kick brought him to the ground had been mended. The suit had been washed and pressed, and his boots shone. I had never seen him looking so posh. Lieutenant Smit and Klipkop both greeted me like an old friend. I could see Doc was agitated, and when Klipkop and Lieutenant Smit moved towards the house, he turned to me urgently.
We must talk, PK. Today is a very difficult thing for me to do.
We followed the 2 warders into the cottage, and Doc pointed to the Steinway and the stool. He was too preoccupied to notice the clean-up, and while I felt a little disappointed, I said nothing. Cleanliness wasn't something I regarded too highly myself. 2 of the other warders came in, leaving Gert and 1 other warder to mind the prisoners. Together with Doc, they discussed how the Steinway might be safely moved. Klipkop went to call the prisoners in, and Doc turned to Lieutenant Smit and asked if he could go and look at his garden, as he couldn't bear to see the piano being moved. Smit laughed and added that it was necessary to have a warder along.
I know Gert Maria. Can he come, please?
I asked. Lieutenant Smit shrugged his shoulders and signaled for Gert to come with us.
I can't have you 2 escaping into the hills now, can I? He said jokingly.
But I was to learn that Lieutenant Smit was a careful man and liked to play things by the book. Gert couldn't speak English, which meant Doc and I could talk without the danger of being overheard. We walked in the garden, following the Johnny Walker bottles as they meandered through the tall cactus and aloe. For a long time, Doc said nothing, stopping to look at plants and bending down to examine succulents which grew close to the ground. It was as though he was trying to memorize the garden, to etch it on a plate in his mind so the memory of it would sustain him in his prison cell. At last we stopped and sat on a natural outcrop of red rock, with our backs to the town below and looking up into the hills. Gert stood some little way away, chewing a piece of grass, his rifle slung carelessly over his shoulder. He seemed happy to be away from his superiors. Finally, Doc started to talk.
PK, these domkopfs want I should do a recital in the town today. I have not played a concert since 16 years. Now I must play again. PK, I cannot do this, but I must.
I looked up at Doc, and I could see that he was terribly distressed.
You don't have to, Doc. They can't force you.
I said defiantly, but without too much conviction. My short experience with authority of any kind had shown me that they always won. They could always force you. Doc turned to look at me.
PK, I love you more than my life. If I don't play today, they will not let you come to see me.
I could feel the despair in his voice as he continued softly.
I do not think I could bear that. I hugged him, and he patted my head, and we sat there and looked at the hills dotted with the aloes in bloom, and at the blue and purple mountains beyond them. At last he spoke again. It was in Berlin in 1925. I had been ill for some months, and I was coming back to the concert circuit with a concert at the Berlin Opera House. I had chosen to play, he turned to me, the score you found in my piano stool. Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 is great music, but it is kind to a good musician. The great master was a piano player himself, and it is not full of clever tricks or passages which try to be schmartypants with the piano player. That night, I played the great master good, better than ever, until the third movement. Suddenly, who knows from where it comes panic. In my fingers comes panic, in my head comes panic, and in my heart comes panic. 30 years of discipline were not enough. The panic swallowed me, and I could not play this music I have played maybe 1,000 times when I practice, and 40 times in concert. Nothing. It was all gone. Just the coughing in the crowd, then the murmuring, then the booing, then the concertmaster leading me from the stage. Doc sat, his head bowed, his hands loosely on his knees. I have never played in front of an audience again. Not since this time in Berlin. Every night for 16 years, I have played the music, the same music, and always in the third movement, it is the same. The music in my fingers and my head and my heart will not proceed. It is then the wolves howl in my head, and only whiskey will make them quiet again. Today, in 1 hour, I must play that music again. I must face the audience, or, my friend, I lose you. I cannot pretend to have understood the depth of Doc's personal dilemma. I was too young, too inexperienced to understand his pain and humiliation. But I knew he was hurting inside, and I knew there was nothing I could do to stop it.
I will be there with you, Doc. I will turn the pages for you.
Doc took out his bandana and blew his nose. You're a good friend, PK. He gave one of his old chuckles and rubbed a hand through my hair and then examined one of my hands. My kneecaps and hands were dirty from weeding between the cactus. Better wash in the tank. If you're going to be my partner, we must look our best. Yeah, this is true. The audience has been waiting 16 years. He rose and took me by the hand. Come, PK. We go now. On the journey into town, Doc and I sat in the front of the van with Lieutenant Smut. Klipkop drove the truck while Hert sat in the back of the van. The Steinway had been loaded onto the flat top and roped. Even so, 5 prisoners were arranged around it to hold it firmly in place on pain of death, while one sat with Doc's piano stool between his legs. About 1/2 mile from the market square, the Diamond T stopped, and the 2 warders herded the 6 blacks off the truck. One of them climbed back on, while the other started to march the prisoners out of town towards the prison. We entered the top of Crown Street, about 300 yards from the market square. The main street was deserted, as quiet as a Sunday afternoon.
Jesus Christ, I hope this doesn't backfire on the commandant,
Lieutenant Smith said, almost as though speaking to himself. We'd been traveling behind the truck, and now we moved ahead of it. I noticed all the shops were closed, even Goodhead's bottle store and the Savoy Café, which never closed for lunch. We turned the corner into the square, and my mouth dropped open. The market square was packed with hundreds of people who had started to cheer as they saw us. A warder signaled us to a space which had been kept clear, under a large flamboyant tree. Lieutenant Smert told Gert to stay with the van, but not to show his rifle. Then he jumped out, and walking in front of the Diamond T, he guided it into a roped-off section in the center of the square. Several warders scrambled up a stepladder onto the flat top and untied the ropes securing the Steinway. One placed Doc's piano stool in place, while another, an electrician from the prison, rigged up a microphone. The moment we saw the crowd, Doc began to shake.
I was half sitting on his knee, and I could feel him quivering.
Piquet, did you do what I said about the water flask? He asked in a tight voice.
It is in the piano stool, Doc.
Piquet, you must take it, and when I ask, you must hand it to me, understand?
I nodded. When we drew to a halt under the large flamboyant tree, the commandant was waiting for us. He opened the van door, and Doc got out, very unsteady on his feet. Commandant Van Zyl took him by the elbow and held him firmly.
Now then, Professor. Remember you are German, a member of a glorious fighting race. We of the South African Prison Service are on your side. You must show these Roynecks what is real culture, man.
Doc looked round fearfully to see if I was by his side.
Do not forget the flask, Piquet, he said.
We walked to the centre of the square, Doc holding tightly onto my hand and being steadied by the commandant. The excitement of the crowd could be felt around us. Nothing like this had happened on a dull Monday since war was declared. We reached the flat top to find that some 20 rows of chairs had been placed behind the ropes on either side of it. The chairs must have come out of the shops and offices, for no two matched, but they formed a ringside audience of the best people in town. Mrs. Boxall was in the front row. She was dressed in her best hat and gloves, as were most of the other town matrons considered of social rank. At the back end of the lorry, in 3 rows of identical chairs, sat the prison warders and their wives, the men in uniform and the women wearing their Sunday best. It was obvious they were very pleased with themselves. Doc had pulled himself together a little by the time we reached the truck, and he and I climbed the stepladder onto the flat top without assistance. The commandant, helped up by Klipkop, climbed the stepladder onto the flat top. Klipkop then walked over to the microphone. "Testing 1, 2, 3, 4," his voice boomed from the four corners of the market square. Satisfied, he climbed down again to join Lieutenant Smert on the ground. The commandant moved over and stood in front of the microphone.
"Dames en heren, ladies and gentlemen," he began, but from then on he spoke in English. "As you all know from reading the newspaper, there has been a very big fuss made about one of our most distinguished citizens, Professor Karl von Fallenstein, a professor of music from across the seas. The good professor, who has lived in this town for 15 years and has taught many of your young daughters to play the piano, was born in Germany. It is for this alone that he is being put under my custody."
Several pockets of people in the crowd had started to boo, and someone shouted,
"Once a Jerry, always a Jerry!"
which brought about a little spasmodic laughter and clapping. The commandant held up his hand.
"I am a Boer, not a Britisher. We Boers know what it is like to be robbed of our rights."
Considerably more booing started, and the same voice in the crowd shouted,
"Put a sock in it, Yarpie!"
The commandant, as though replying to the heckler, continued,
"No, it is true, I must say it. You took our freedom, and now you are taking the professor's."
This time the booing started in earnest, and suddenly Mr. O'Grady Smith, the mayor, stood up and shouted up at the commandant,
"Get on with it, man, or we'll have a riot!"
The commandant turned angrily on the mayor, oblivious of the microphone in front of him.
"Don't you bloody tell me to get on with it! Just because you're the mayor of this dorp, you think you can boss people around, eh?"
The booing stopped, for Mr. O'Grady Smith was no more popular than the commandant. He was also a very fat man and at least 10 inches shorter than the commandant. He strode from his seat and with the help of a couple of town councillors mounted the stepladder and walked over to the microphone. Standing on tiptoes, he shouted into the loudspeaker,
"It's high time we move the jail and the nest of Nazis who run it out of Barberton. This town is loyal to King George and the British Empire. God save the King!"
Most of the crowd clapped and cheered and whistled, and Mr. O'Grady Smith turned and looked up at the commandant, a smug, self-righteous expression on his face. From where I stood next to Doc on the flat top, I could see about a dozen men making their way through the crowd towards us.
"Some men are coming,"
I said to Lieutenant Smith, who was now standing beside the stepladder with Klipkop to discourage any further townsfolk from emulating the mayor. They quickly mounted the flat top, pulled up the ladder and placed the microphone next to the Steinway so that the bottom half of the flat top was clear. Without any ceremony, the mayor and the commandant were hastily pushed to the top end to stand beside the seated Doc and me. There was a good 10 feet between the truck and the first row of seats behind the ropes. This was to allow the more important citizens a clear view of Doc at the piano. The attackers crossed this strip of no man's land and swarmed onto the back of the flat top. Lieutenant Smut and Klipkop held the high ground, which evened things out considerably, while the other warders took the clearing between the lorry and the seats. The flat top and the apron around it were filled with fighting men, and the screams of the ladies as they tried to back away from the brawl. The commandant ventured out from behind the Steinway and received a punch on the nose. Fat Mr. O'Grady Smith was crouched on all fours halfway under the piano, trying to look invisible. Only Mrs. Boxall stood her ground and was waving desperately in our direction, and, I suddenly realized, at me.
"Jump down, PK! Run for it! Jump! Jump!" she screamed.
Just then, Doc tugged me on the sleeve.
"The flask, PK."
His hand was outstretched. I handed the flask of whiskey to him, and he unscrewed the cap and took a slug and handed it back to me.
"When I make my head like so, you must turn the page."
He turned to the score in front of him and paged quickly to the beginning of the fortissimo movement, which in Beethoven's Fifth occurs at the end of the second movement. Then he started to play. The microphone had been knocked down, and its head now rested over the upright section of the piano. It picked up the music, which now thundered across the square. Almost immediately the crowd grew quiet, and the fighting stopped. The flat top cleared, and the men around the apron slipped back into the crowd. The mayor squeezed out from under the Steinway. He and the commandant were helped down the replaced stepladder. Even the sobbing ladies soon grew quiet. On and on Doc played, through the second into the third movement, and hardly pausing into the fourth, his head nodding every time he wanted the page turned. It was a faultless performance, as he brought the recital to a thunderous close. Intellectually, the audience had probably understood very little of it. It was not, after all, their kind of music. But emotionally, they would remember Doc's performance for the rest of their lives. Mrs. Boxall was weeping and clutching her hands to her breast, and the other ladies also pretended to be swept away with it all. Lieutenant Smut shouted at several of the warders, who began to clear a way for the truck. Lifting the microphone off the back, he shouted for Klipkop to get into the truck and drive away, then he jumped into the passenger side of the cabin as the big diamond T started to move. Doc, who had been bowing to the crowd, fell back onto his seat. With a flourish of the keyboard, he began to play Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. I had never seen him as happy. He played all the way back to the prison, not stopping when we got to the gates and reaching the final bars as we drew up outside the administration building. Then he took a long swig from the flask and rose from the piano and looked out over the prison walls to his beloved hills. I quickly opened the piano stool and put the flask into it together with the score. I locked it and slipped the key into my pocket. Doc rubbed his hand through my hair.
"No more wolves. Absoluto," he said quietly.
Then he looked up at the hills again. 12. D or Dumb woke me up at 4:45 every morning with coffee and a rusk. Shortly after 5, I strapped my leather book bag to my shoulders and was offered a trot to the prison some 3 miles down the road. I was let in the gates without equivocation, as regular as the milkman and just as harmless. The guards, with an hour and a half to go before the night shift ended, waved from the walkway on the wall. They were weary from the boredom of guard duty, and I was the first tangible sign after the grey dawn that the long night was almost over. I learnt that the greatest camouflage of all is consistency. If you do something often enough and at the same time in the same way, you become invisible, one of the shadows. Every recidivist knows this. In prison, to be successful, plans have to be laid long term. Habits have to be established little by little, each day or week or month or even year, a minute progression towards the ultimate goal. When a routine is finally set, authorities no longer see it for what it is, a deception, but accept it for what it isn't, an authorized routine. The prisoner enjoys the advantage over his keeper of continuity. Warders change, get promoted, move elsewhere, but old lags, those prisoners who remain inside with long sentences, have the advantage of time to plan. In prison, the old lag is the real authority. The warder unwittingly depends on the old lags to run the prison system, for it is they who restrain the younger prisoners who lack the patience to go along with the system, or who see violence as the only solution to getting what they want. A prison without this secondary system of authority can be a dangerous and unpredictable place. I found myself part of this shadow world, brought into it with great patience over a long period by an old toothless lag known as Giel Piet. Translated from Afrikaans, his name simply meant Yellow Peter. In fact, it was more than simply a name. Giel Piet was a half-caste, or a Cape Coloured, neither black nor white, treated as a black man, but aspiring in his soul to be a white one. Giel Piet was the limbo man of Africa, despised by both sides. He was also a recidivist, an incorrigible criminal, who freely admitted that it was hopeless for him on the outside. Giel Piet was the old lag who exerted the most influence in the shadow world of the prison. My prison day began in the gymnasium at 5:30 a.m., where the boxing squad, under the direction of Lieutenant Smit, assembled for calisthenics. There were 20 of us altogether, and this included 4 other kids between 11 and 15. Seniority went by weight, with Klipkop, who had defeated Jackhammer Smit on points over 10 rounds, and was now the low-felt heavyweight champion, the most senior, down to myself at the very bottom of the ladder. Lieutenant Smit stood in the boxing ring with a whistle in his mouth, and to a series of whistles we would perform a routine of exercises familiar to everyone. These were interspersed with push-ups and sit-ups at any interval Lieutenant Smit wanted them. Each session of push-ups and sit-ups was of longer duration than the previous one. Lieutenant Smit was a big believer in push-ups to strengthen the arms and the shoulders, and sit-ups to strengthen the gut muscles. He also liked fighters, and contended that the Boer made a better fighter than boxer, and that most prison warders were naturally aggressive and better equipped to be fighters. He said toughness and determination overcame skill in the ring. The boxers from Barberton Prison were known throughout the Lowveld and as far as Petersburg and Pretoria as tough men to take on. Lieutenant Smit was true to his word, and for the first 2 years he would not allow me to step into the ring. "When you can throw a medicine ball over Klipkop's head, then you will be ready," he said. The first of my goals was set, and for the 15 minutes after calisthenics, when all the other boxers were paired off with sparring partners, I worked until I could no longer lift my arms. After a 5-minute shower, I reported to the prison hall for my piano lesson with Doc, and at 7:30 we would both go into breakfast at the warder's mess. Doc had a special status in the prison. While he lived in a cell, he could come and go as he pleased. He ate in the warder's mess and wasn't required to do any special work.
"You just play the piano, Professor," Commandant Van Zyl had said. "That's your job, you hear?"
Doc often wandered into the gymnasium to watch the squad going through its paces. He knew that I yearned to box, to stand up against another person in the ring. While he made it clear that he didn't understand why I should have such a need, he respected my ambition and soothed my impatience with musical analogies.
"In music, you must first do the exercises. Always first the exercises. If you do the exercises good, then you have the foundations. You cannot build a good musician on a bad foundation. I think with this boxing business it is the same. Yeah, I think this is true."
And so I did all the things required of a boxer and practiced on the punching bag until the whole armory of punches was as familiar to me as the piano scales. That old punching bag took a terrible hiding on a daily basis over those first 2 years. I would imagine it cowering as it saw me approach, sometimes even whimpering, "Not too many of those deadly uppercuts today, PK," or, "Oh no, not the right cross, I can't take any more right crosses." I'm telling you, man, that big old punching bag learned to respect me all right. but it was the speedball which I grew to love. Gert, the young warder who spoke no English, was also in the boxing squad, and we'd become firm friends. He'd modified an old punching bag in the prison workshop so that it stood low enough for me to reach. I can remember the first day when, after many weeks of practice on the speedball, I achieved a continuity of rhythm, the ball a blur in front of my boxing gloves. I imagine Fred Astaire or Bojangles must have felt the same way when they got their first complete tap dance sequence from their taps. After several weeks, Lieutenant Smut walked over to watch me. My heart pounded as I concentrated on keeping the speedball flurried, a blurred rhythmic tat-tat-tat-tat of leather on leather.
"You're fast, PK." "That's good," he said, and then walked away.
2 years later, when I mastered a difficult passage in the Chopin prelude, the thrill was minor compared to Lieutenant Smith's praise. They had been the first words he had specifically directed at me in the 6 months I had been on his squad. Doc Steinway was kept in the prison hall, a fairly large room with a sprung wooden floor, used mostly for tiki dry dancing and other events in the lives of prison officers and their families. There was also an upright French mignon piano, for Doc Steinway was not to be used except to play classical music. This was an express order from Commandant Van Zyl, who pointed out that a piano of such superior qualities should not be expected to play tiki dry or to accompany the banjo or accordion. Naturally, his wishes were respected, and the Steinway became a symbol of something very superior, which in the eyes of the prison officers and their families elevated them and gave them a special social status. Doc and I, the only two people who played on the Steinway, were included in this status. While my own playing was elementary and far from competent, it was respected as proper music and was referred to as my gift. The fact that the great German professor of music gave me lessons was the only confirmation needed that I must be a budding genius. Doc was kind enough never to contradict this opinion. While being the most honest person I have ever known, he was not a fool. He quickly learnt that every small advantage in the prison system was mental capital in the bank. But it was a shame that his brilliance as a teacher was wasted on such inferior clay. I visited the cactus garden most days on my return from school, and every Sunday after church I went with Dee and Dum to clean Doc's cottage and work in the garden. Doc and I discussed the progress of the cactus garden in detail from a chart prepared by him of every succulent and cactus species in the garden. Considering there were several thousand, it was an intellectual task of some brilliance. In correcting the chart, which took me some weeks, I found that he had only made 11 errors. Taking a small patch of garden at a time from the chart, I reported on its progress. Doc made notes on the comings and goings of blossoms, and instructed me when to thin or separate plants. The separated plants I put in a hessian bag and brought it to the prison, where Doc had started a second cactus garden. Sometimes insects ate a cactus bloom, and I'd capture a specimen in a matchbox and bring it to Doc for identification. If it was within my capacity to do anything about them, he instructed me in their elimination. This was rare. Doc believed all creatures had a place in the system, and in the end everything sorted itself out. It was only when an insect appeared in such numbers that it was likely to disrupt the ecology of the garden that he instructed me to act. He would liken this to a locust plague, which, though a natural thing, was a riotous act of nature which should be contained. In these cases, he supplied the know-how, Mrs. Boxall or my grandpa supplied the materials, and Dee and Dum supplied the labor. Usually the enemy was overcome. The girls saw this as part of their Sunday outing and took great pride in their work. They enjoyed the business of working with the soil, though I dare say so much effort on something as silly as a cactus must have left them bemused. Marie, the little nurse from the hospital, had been invited home soon after my jaw incident and had become firm friends with my mother. She loved needlework and would sit for hours chatting away to my mother and doing buttonholes and making shoulder pads and bits and pieces. It seemed certain she would soon fall into the clutches of the Lord. Being a farm girl, she understood Dee and Dum, and to my surprise only bossed them about a little. She taught them to cook a number of new dishes, including pumpkin scones and cornbread, and they soon became my favorites. I took her to see Doc's cottage one Sunday afternoon. The two black girls were silent for most of the way. When she arrived at the cottage, Marie started to tell them what to do. Their faces grew longer and longer as the afternoon progressed. At last even I saw the mistake I had made, and Marie, much to the delight of Dee and Dum, wasn't invited again. I think they both liked Marie a lot, but there are certain things between women that mustn't be tampered with. Doc's house wasn't his anymore, it belonged to Dum and Dee, and Marie's imperious instructions were those of an intruder, or even a guest who had forgotten her manners. Marie brought sweet potatoes for me from her farm, and fresh eggs, sometimes even a leg of pork, a churn of farm butter, or several pounds of home-cured bacon. She always brought a large bunch of cured tobacco leaf for my grandpa. He smoked a Rhodesian blend called African Drum, and hated the sharp, raw, unblended tobacco from Marie's farm, though he was much too polite to tell her. He would hang it by the stems from the ceiling of the garden shed. Occasionally he added a couple of large leaves to a 44-gallon drum filled with rainwater, which stood directly outside the shed. The tobacco-infused water was used for aphids on the roses, but the water required only a tincture of tobacco, and the supply hanging from the ceiling grew alarmingly. Eventually it was to become one of the most important factors in my rise within the prison system. For the first year, Giel Piet, the half-caste, was a part of morning piano practice, for he was always in the hall on his knees, polishing the floor. After a short while he became entirely invisible, a shadow in the background, who greeted Doc and myself with "Goeiemorgen, baas, en klein baas." He followed this with a toothless smile, and then a soft cackle, as though the day was perfect and he couldn't think of any place he'd rather be. Doc, who was no racist, and I, who had mixed with servants all my life, both returned his greeting. It was forbidden to talk to any of the non-European prisoners, and our careless replies must have been a great encouragement to the old man. Giel Piet was small and battered-looking. His left eye hung lower than his right, and the bottom eyelid drooped, showing more of the eye than one would normally see. Both eyes were permanently bloodshot and somewhat weepy. His nose had been completely flattened, and his deep yellow face was crisscrossed with scars. A section of his bottom lip had been cut away, leaving a purple wedge of scar tissue to droop in a line of permanent disappointment from the corner of his mouth. He stood around 5'2" on his buckled legs, for they were more than simply bandy, the result of having been broken several times and no doubt carelessly mended. Had he been able to straighten them, he might well have been 4 or 5 inches taller. In the process of surviving, Giel Piet had achieved an outward appearance which would have made it near impossible for him to last for very long outside the jail system. He had worn out his luck in the outside world, if indeed he'd ever had any. Born in District 6, the notorious coloured township in Cape Town, Giel Piet had been in and out of jail for 40 of his 55 years. He took pride in the fact that he knew the working at an intimate level of every major prison in South Africa, and he was the grand master in the art of camouflage. Should a warder beat him for whatever imagined reason, Giel Piet bore no animosity, no hate. He had long since transcended both, and regarded a beating as self-inflicted because it resulted from some piece of carelessness. Giel Piet had no sense of morality, no sense of right or wrong. He existed for only one reason, to survive the system and to beat it, to gain more from it than he was entitled to. He had long since realized that for him anyway, freedom was an illusion. He had accumulated years of sentences, he wasn't quite sure or no longer cared how many, and was realist enough to know that he was unlikely to survive the system at his age and with his deteriorating health. After all the years of incarceration, he was a polished performer, no less a maestro at his profession than Doc was at his. Perhaps more so, for as a procurer, Giel Piet was a genius. Giel Piet ran the prison black market, in tobacco, sugar, salt, and dacha, cannabis. In the end, he controlled the mail coming and going from the prison, and thus the money brought in. He also had an encyclopedic knowledge of boxing, and a rare gift for spotting errors of style and weakness in performance. My desire to become a boxer was all too apparent, but it is a sixth sense to men who have to survive on their wits, and you have to sniff the air before every move and wager everything on a chance observation or a cunning guess, that told him I was an easy mark. It took just over a year for Gil Piet to ingratiate himself